Chapter 13. To High Watch? King Handor sat forward in his velvet-lined chair in a private corner of his study.
Indeed, sire. It's perfect, said Bowlby Bags. The fortress has never fallen, no doubt due to its position in the cruel high walls. Better still, it's just on our side of the Ruskan border, added Fenrir Goldson. Yet not so close that King Clenn could reasonably accuse you of baiting the undead into the Freedlands for the loot. So it's defensible in two ways, added Bags.
Yes, I've already agreed on as much, said Handor. I'm just not sure why we would go there.
We'll only make the journey if you wish, sire.
Bags poured himself a finger of halfling sour rum and dropped in two ice cubes.
And we'd fly, of course, said Goldson, sipping his own drink from a spot near the fire. Fastest way to travel.
But why go at all? Said Handor.
To protect our investments, sire.
Bags settled into a comfortable armchair.
To ensure that the plan is executed properly.
They want to make sure those giant orbs get used before guild heroes finish the lich off,
grumbled Weaver Ortson. The master of the Heroes Guild was unusually sober for this time of evening.
Otherwise they won't get their finder's fee for bringing Clubs and his Umbraxians in.
Indeed, said Bags with a withering look at Ortson. We also wish to ensure the heroes from our subsidiaries have the first rights to fight the Lich itself. And it does promise some entertainment, said Goldson.
Always a factor, said Bags. Regardless, we heard your majesty might also be interested in providing inspiration and leadership for the troops.
And more importantly, that you might be interested in being seen providing inspiration and leadership for the troops, said Goldson.
Handor nodded. He wouldn't mind hearing tales of his bravery from the town criers.
But is it safe? He asked.
Ha! High Watch is the greatest fortress on Arth outside of Andoran, said Johann the Mighty. It hasn't been successfully assaulted in 1,000 years.
We wouldn't take such a trip ourselves, let alone suggest your majesty take it, if we weren't confident that the Bannermen could protect us all, said Bags.
The Bannermen can't keep a simple staff safe in the middle of a fortified museum at the heart of our city, snapped Ortson. I shouldn't trust them with your majesty's safety.
We're all unhappy about the museum robbery, Ortson, Handor said, staring into the crackling fire. I'm especially concerned that I heard a rumor that it might have been Gorm Ingerson's band of outlaws who perpetrated it. The room fell silent. Johann's perpetual smile faded just a little. It's possible, sire, but I don't want to jump to that conclusion.
No, I shouldn't if I were you, Handor said. Especially as you've given me your word, Ingerson would be dead by now.
Ingerson will meet his end very shortly, said Johann stiffly, as will whoever stole the Wormwood staff.
See that it's so, said Handor.
He turned back to Goldson and Bags.
And you remain confident that this trip is safe?
We watch heroes at work on a regular basis, your majesty, said Bags. Why, just last month, Mr. Goldson and I flew out to watch a team from Adventure Capital clear a warren of Skargs outside of Fenrose Heath.
An excellent show, said Goldson,
and we stopped for supper in the Hearth Wards on the way home.
The undead are more dangerous than Skargs, said Handor pensively.
Yes, but High Watch is safer than the tents we had set up outside the Skarg nests, said Bags.
The journey isn't without risks, conceded Goldson, but we've taken every precaution to mitigate the danger. We'll have a vantage point set up atop the inner keep, bodyguards from the Heroes Guild, and flights waiting nearby to evacuate us in the unlikely event that the battle goes the wrong way.
We doubt it would come to such measures, naturally, said Bags. When you've observed as many quests as Fenrir and I, you get a sense of how these things tend to go.
Yeah, this is typical, said Bert. Everyone always forgets about the little guy.
They didn't forget you, said Thane,
plucking the note off the tree at the edge of the former campsite.
They told you where they're going and how to follow them.
Yeah, leaving a kobold on his own in the wilderness, snarled Bert. My people don't do anything alone, let alone travel. I might get eaten by a wild boar for all they know.
They know I'm here with you.
Thane glanced over the note again. The kobold kicked at a stone in the damp earth.
Half of them do. The other half may as well have left me to die.
The troll squinted at the paper in his hands.
Where is High Watch?
East, sighed the kobold, scrabbling up the troll's arm.
Bones, how are we going to catch them on those fancy horses of theirs?
Keeping pace with the elven steeds on the journey to Andoran had stretched the troll to his considerable limits.
They only have a few hours' head start, said Thane. If we camp late, we can catch up over the course of a day or two. You really think we can make up the lost ground? We have to.
Thane slipped the note into a pouch he wore on his bandolier. Bert heard glass vials clicking together within it.
Maybe we have to go, maybe we don't, said Bert. We could just send a letter. Bert, they need us.
The troll gave a fanged grin to his passenger.
Did they really write anything that offensive? It ain't what's in the note, fumed Bert. It's the fact that they left a note at all. It just says something, you know?
It sends a message, said Haraldin grimly. Geist looked down at the brightly colored cork that the bard pressed into his hand. It was narrower at one end, with a red stick driven through its center. A tiny hole was drilled through each end of the stick, and a length of string wound through them.
You don't leave a fishing buoy in a man's saddlebags unless you want him to know he's dead.
Haraldin pointed at the cork.
This says I'll be taking a trip down the river, or sleeping with the fishes, or on the hook. You choose whatever metaphor you like, so long as it implies that I'm not long for this world.
Geist raised an eyebrow, though almost imperceptibly.
It's from Benny Hookhand, snapped the bard. He knows I robbed the museum.
Geist stared into the simmering coals in the center of the camp, all that remained of the evening's cookfire.
It was the stable boy, fumed the bard, stalking around the fire. That little knock-kneed, pimply, scum-sucking slug? He must be in the Hookhand's pockets. That's why he was asking so many questions. I bet he got a tip about me from someone in Benny's organization, and then the bloody stupid dwarf all but confirmed we robbed the museum to him.
Geist shrugged.
You do not understand, my friend, sighed the bard, gripping his forehead in his hand. I tricked the Hookhand into a truce long ago, and for years he has been waiting for me to slip up and break the peace. Now he knows I've been thieving, and he's free to take his revenge. Who knows what terrible death he has in store for me?
Geist looked at the bard, ferocity blazing in his dark eyes.
True, I am traveling with a weapons master of remarkable talents, and I trust in you, my friend.
Haraldin's smile held no joy. You may keep me out of trouble for a time. The bard sighed and looked at the buoy in his hand. But Benny Hookhand is relentless. He will not rest until he has me, and once he does, it will be my end. To get a fishing buoy in your backpack means that someday, sooner rather than later, death comes for you.
I mean, we're all going to die eventually, right?
Said the guard. Hannah shook her head.
This is madness, Chovek.
It's not. We all pass on one day or another, and today seems to be ours.
Chovek waved a hand toward the grassland beyond Perald's shining walls. The fields were black in the waning sunlight, every yard of them crammed with stinking corpses that stared up at the city's last defenders with hollow, hungry eyes.
Our duty is to protect our city,
said Hannah, though she couldn't sound as certain as she wanted to. She glanced at Fiora for backup, but the portly guard was busy reading a paper flyer. Similar brochures drifted down over the ramparts all around the cluster of soldiers.
And what are we defending? Said Chovek. The families and elders have fled toward Edelmon and Aberyth. The heroes aren't coming. The city will fall, with or without us.
With or without you,
Fiora read along, her finger holding her place on the flyer.
Yeah, that's what this ad says.
Chovek held up his own paper as a cleric wields a holy symbol.
It also says nobody will eat me if I take advantage of this special offer.
You mean joining the undead,
said Hannah, her hand on her hilt.
We're all going to join them one way or another. That's the point.
Chovek pointed out at the waiting army.
Do you think any of them had a choice? We're no better off than they were, except we can avoid getting mauled and eaten alive.
Fiora gasped and held her hands to her cheeks.
But how?
Just show up outside the walls with a copy of the flyer in hand, Chovek read. But we have to act now. This offer ends at sunset.
Oh, yeah. They've got this little box that tells you everything you need to do,
Fiora marveled, looking down at the flyer.
Well, it's important to have a clear call to action, said Chovek.
But we don't have time, said Fiora. The sun's almost down, and we'd never make it out of the gates in time.
Well, that's only because of all the sods clogging the stairs.
Chovek pointed to the base of the wall, where a steady flow of deserters trickled out from the guardhouses, waving flyers in the air above their heads.
There's got to be a faster way down.
Hannah's sword rang as she pulled it from her scabbard.
Enough, she growled. You can't betray our nation, our people.
Chovek and Fiora glanced down at the lieutenant's sword, and then at each other, and finally at the sun dropping behind the horizon. Chovek sneered. Fiora licked her lips.
Now, said Hannah slowly, you will take up your spears, hold the...
Fiora broke away. Two steps took the stout woman to the edge of the wall, and her third launched her over the edge, a flyer gripped firmly in her hand. A moment later, Hannah heard a wet thump from below. Hannah's mouth opened and shut as she turned back to Chovek. The wiry man was already shifting toward the edge of the wall.
Don't,
Hannah said, raising her sword.
Oh.
Don't blame yourself, he said. It wouldn't have made a difference anyway.
With that, Chovek gave her his typical smirk and stepped back over the edge.
And bam, just like that, they're on our side, said the head of marketing. It's brilliant. We're converting the enemy without firing a single arrow.
Tyrann Urthos looked at the walls of Perald. Beneath the city's flickering dome of magical wards and protective spells, he could see the thinning ranks of soldiers lining the ramparts. The sun had just set on Perald, and now the undead were waiting for moonrise to let the metaphor follow through.
Impressive, said Tyrann.
He sat on a large rock in the middle of a clearing marked off with red rope attached to several posts. A gap in the left rope marked an entrance to his makeshift office, within which were several undead lined up to meet with him. Another gap to the right was marked with an exit sign. In between the signs, the corrupted earth was bare, save for an old table that served as Tyrann's desk.
Impressive doesn't cover it, said the floating skull. 7% of Perald's defenders self-converted. 7%! Do you know how many of the living have defected to our side before now? Ever? In all of history? I'll give you a hint. I could count them on my fingers, and I don't have any fingers.
It's an excellent conversion rate, agreed the Knight Commander, flipping through the pages in the marketing report.
At first he was surprised to see all the red ink in the head's numbers, but he quickly realized that it probably wasn't red ink.
Excellent work. Anything else?
We've been doing some brand work for Lady Caribay, given her recent promotion. That's on page 6, said the head of marketing.
Lady Caribay, mistress of 1,000 thralls, the Knight Commander read.
Is she beguiling or deadly? Why choose?
The head bobbed excitedly as it spoke.
She doesn't have 1,000 thralls, said Tyrann.
The head of marketing rolled its eye.
It's creative exaggeration. You've got to allow for a bit of hyperbole if you want to build a memorable brand.
A bit?
Tyrann looked up from the sheet.
She can't have more than a dozen or so vampire thralls. I mean, best case scenario is that you're off by a factor of 50, right?
Well, the mistress of 12 or so thralls doesn't exactly rattle the bones, does it, sir? But I'll change it if you want. You're the boss, after all.
The head couldn't stop the flames around his head from flaring a little higher when he noted Tyrann's relatively recent rank increase. Jealousy and resentment radiated from the skull, along with infernal heat. Tyrann sighed.
Listen, the master may have put me in charge of a number of functions recently,
to say the least, grumbled the skull,
but I believe leadership is all about empowering people to do their work. Trust me, I don't want to do your job.
Tyrann's favorite management line was disarming, because it was absolutely true. The Knight Commander didn't want to do anyone's job, including his own.
You're still the head of marketing. I'm here to help you be the best head of marketing you can.
I know, the skull nodded reluctantly.
Listen, if you think that's the right brand for Lady Caribay, you run with it.
The Knight Commander held up his hands. I'm not here to get in your way. You've been delivering. Keep it up.
All right, yeah. The head of marketing gave Tyron an inscrutable stare. Yeah. Thanks.
No. Thank you.
Tyron pointed at the skull and tried to wink a couple of times before he remembered that his eyelids were gone. He opted to snap his finger bones together instead.
I really appreciate all your great progress. I just wish I had more time to talk about it.
Oh, right. Right. The head of marketing bobbed off toward the exit. Thanks, Knight Commander.
Any time.
Tyron leaned back in the old chair. He still had his natural talent for delegation. Only a master of middle management could give away all of the work for a project, stay in a place to get much of the credit, and still get thanked for it. The knack must have been in his bones, as evidenced by the fact that there wasn't anywhere else for it to be. Perhaps Undeath hadn't taken that much away from him after all. His next meeting, Ned and Ted shambled in through the rope, while Rudge and his group of skeletons shuffled to take their place in the line. Tyron looked up at the stars winking into view across the sky. The moon would rise soon.
Let's try to get through these last two meetings quickly, he said. The attack is about to start.
Ah, eager to get on the front lines, eh, sir? Said Ted, stepping up to Tyron's desk.
Something like that.
Tyron was actually eager to be at the front of the middle ranks, far enough back that he wouldn't get his hands dirty, but close enough to the fore to keep up appearances.
How is the demonic animal husbandry team coming along?
Could be better, said Ned, the newly appointed stable master of the damned. We've lost one, I'm afraid.
Tyron sat up.
You let one of those demon animals get away?
Oh, no, sir, said Ted. We lost a stable hand. Turns out the infernal beasts can fly when sufficiently motivated, and apparently seeing a zombie too close to the training pit was sufficient motivation for Boris. That's what we call the boar, said Ned.
Really?
Tyron steepled his hands.
Yes, sir, said the ghoul. We've named all the beasts. They're right vicious bastards, but you know how it is. You work with anything long enough and you start to get attached.
I meant that I was surprised they ate another stable hand, said Tyron. I thought you said you were making progress with the animals.
Oh, we are, sir, said Ted. Why, we've gotten to the point where old Boris doesn't try to kill Ned and I. Provided he's eating someone else at the time, added Ned. And Scruffles, that's our hellhound. Why, I don't think he's aggressive at all, said Ted. He's trying to be affectionate. Not that it makes much difference. He'll melt your face off either way, said Ned. And nobody is taming that weasel.
Ghoul and zombie paused for a moment to shudder in unison at the mention of the mustelid.
So, progress then? Said Tyron.
I'd say as much, said Ned. It's still rough going, but we're much better off than where we started.
Good, good, said the Knight Commander. Well, let me say that those demonic beasts are very important to the Master, as is everything related to that Kraken mission.
The Leviathan Project, sir, said Ted.
Right, said Tyron. Anything related to that project is top priority. Rudge and his relic recovery team will be searching the city for connected items and documents.
Yes, sir!
Rudge and all of his skeletons saluted, save for the odd one with no arms, no head, and a sign nailed to his chest.
You've made some great gains on a top project in just a week, Tyron told Ned and Ted. Keep this up, and who knows how high you'll go in this organization.
To the Knight Commander's surprise, the promise of a reward didn't have much of an effect. Ned and Ted exchanged a knowing look.
Very good, sir, said Ned, without enthusiasm.
No, wait, Tyron said, pointing a bony finger at the ghoul. I'm telling you, you've got a great career here with the undead. You should be excited.
It sounds nice, said Ned. We just don't believe we're going to get promoted. You know how that flyer on your desk says that rich or poor, noble or low-born, all are equal in death?
Asked Ted.
Yes,
said Tyron, glancing at the page.
It's rubbish, Ned pronounced. What we've actually got is a rigid caste system based on which sorcerer's curse brought you to undeath, said Ted. Your rank among the dead is entirely determined by the nature of the magic that binds you, which in turn often depends on your character in life.
Ned nodded.
The master made himself a lich, the highest of the high, and beneath him we're all arrayed down to the lowest of the lows, the skeletons.
What, really?
Asked Tyron.
Oh, yes, said Ned. Nobody wants to be a skeleton.
It's true, said Rudge.
I meant about the caste system, said Tyron.
Very much so, sir, said Ted. All we are is magic and force of will made manifest, and higher ranks of undead have both of those in spades, so much so that they can take control over the rest of us. The lower your caste, the less you can control yourself when some necromancer or higher undead is telling you what to do. Not to mention the less chance you stand against the armies of the living, said Ned. Oh yes, that's a given, said Ted. The point is, we've got an inherent hierarchy that favors the powerful. Undeath is much easier for a ghost than for a zombie such as myself. And vampires have it pretty thrice-cursed good as well, Ned added. Lying around on red silk and seducing young virgins willy-nilly while us ghouls can't find a decent meal. Just look at Ned and me, said Ted. I outranked Nedded in the service of the city of Vetchel, in part because he was always a bit of a glutton. I prefer to say I had a taste for the finer things, said Ned. I'm sure you would, said Ted. But the point is, when the master cursed us, Ned's appetites transformed him into a ghoul, whereas myself, not having any character-defining flaws, nor any personality whatsoever, Ned muttered, I just became your basic zombie. Ted shook his head sadly. And now he outranks me, just like all the people with unfinished business who became ghosts, or the spiteful murderers who became wraiths and the like.
But we're running an undead invasion like Arth has never seen before. This time is different.
Tyrion held up a bony hand.
I mean, look, I'm a skeleton and I've come far.
Ned scoffed. Please, sir, you may be skeletal, but you're not a skeleton.
Definitely not. I saw him looking around when the master had his crown on, Ted told the ghoul. He could move his head and everything.
I saw it too, said Ned. I can barely keep my wits about me when the master is within 100 yards, to say nothing of when he's wearing the crown. But Knight Commander Urthos here was making suggestions about the advertising and volunteering for a leadership post.
I was showing initiative, said Tyrion.
I'll bet he's a white, opined Ted. Maybe even an arch-white, on account of his high stature in life and desire to protect his territory.
Ah, but you're forgetting that whites come from opulent tombs, Ted, said Nedard.
My money is on a revenant.
Ted shook his head.
Can't be. Revenants look as they did in life so they can stalk their prey among the living, and our knight commander definitely looks...
Zombie and ghoul looked at Tyrion and then at each other.
Well, let's say he's lost weight, Ted finished carefully. So, it's not all appearances, is it?
Said Ned.
Listen, revenants are the spirits of evil men who die dishonorable deaths, right?
Said Ted.
Remember Carl?
Ned's face screwed up at the name.
Ugh, total rubbish, Carl was. A bully and a fool. And a deserter. So, now, he's a revenant, said Ted. Our knight commander here was a man of the highest character to the very end. He died defending the gate with us, if you'll recall.
Right. Said Tyrion.
I don't know, said Ned. I think that sort of creation myth might just be another example of folklore using a simple moral duality to whitewash what is in reality a complex series of factors.
A ghoul would say that, yes, said Ted.
Tyrion covered his eye sockets with a bony hand.
Enough. Does it really matter if I'm a revenant or not?
Begging your pardon, sir, but you'd have to be a white to say as much, said Ned.
At least, agreed Ted.
The whole caste thing may not seem that important when you're sitting up top, but those of us down near the bottom of the sorcerer's economic ladder think about it constantly.
It doesn't matter, the knight commander shook his head. Maybe it used to, but not anymore. We're changing the way things are done. The living have never volunteered to join the undead before, remember? And the master's plan is never going to work if people don't have an incentive to succeed.
Nor would Tyrion's designs, but he kept that point to himself.
"Do you really think so, sir?" asked Ned.
"I know so," said Tyrion. "Listen, we're doing big things here. We can change the model, break down old barriers."
"Yeah,"
Ted bubbled with growing enthusiasm.
"We can do this!"
"There's no question in my mind," said Tyrion.
A shuffling sound caught his attention.
"Well, perhaps one question. Do you think we're ready to deploy the infernal beasts?"
"Now?"
The excitement drained back out of the zombie. Tyrion looked around. The ghoulish brigades around Tyrion's office had lurched into motion, literally in most cases. The front ranks of the undead army were already moving toward the doomed city of Perrald.
"Yes, now would be good."
It ain't like we've got much time left, you know. Gorm spread his hands out. That Nurg's almost lost us, and once one of them scaly bastards goes to ground, there's no telling how long it'll take to find it again.
That's what I hate most about Nurgs, said Laruna. Something that big shouldn't be able to hide that well.
Or move that fast, said Heraldin. Gods, Nurgs are the worst. Laughter rang out around the remnants of the cookfire. With the wormwood staff in their possession, the museum guards at their backs, and the horses making a great pace, the heroes had been in high spirits in the days since leaving Andoran. They'd even found time to buy a bundle of rations and a skin of wine from an inn just outside of Hertswood, and now they were enjoying one of the best meals Gorm could remember.
Exactly, said Gorm, pointing at the Solomancer with his spoon. So, our rogue yells, we're falling behind. But I stands up on my horse and I says, no, I'm getting ahead. Ha! So I jump.
Wait, Laruna interrupted. You said what?
He's getting ahead, Heraldin snickered. Gorm nodded.
Aye, so I jumped.
You made a joke, said Laruna, in the middle of a fight?
Yeah, because I was gonna, you know,
Gorm used his spoon to pantomime a few axe blows, I was gonna chop off its head. The mage was incredulous.
It was a struggle for life and death with a giant, monstrous worm. Why were you making a pun?
And a really bad one at that, said Jin. Gorm gave an exasperated shrug.
It was just a quip.
A quip? Do heroes often engage in wordplay when killing things? The wizard asked with a smirk. Do palindromes or anagrams count? Or is it more about observational humor?
When I'm fighting, I'm not running around making jokes, said Laruna.
Not jokes, said Heraldin. A quip. You're allowed to make one. Only one, though.
Oh, aye. Any more than that would be in poor taste.
Gorm spoke through a mouthful of chicken and potatoes.
One is in bad taste, said Laruna. Why would anyone say it's all right to make a joke in the middle of a life-and-death fight?
Gorm shrugged.
I don't know. It's one of them unspoken rules.
Yes, I thought everybody knew that, agreed Heraldin. Geist knows. Geist sat motionless on the edge of the firelight. The bard nodded at the weapons master. See?
No, laughed Jin.
And I'm fairly certain he isn't making jokes in the heat of battle, said Laruna.
Maybe he is, Heraldin grinned. Maybe you just don't get them. The Solomancer stopped herself and looked at the weapons master, who suddenly seemed a bit more aloof.
Well, I think it's silly.
Maybe, but it can keep your mind off the stress a bit, said Gorm. And it looks great in a quest report. My publicist used to love it when I had a good quip. The town criers go nuts for 'em. Katha, your publicist must have...
Gorm trailed off as the heroes turned to the elf. She looked back at them with sullen, hollow eyes.
What?
She said softly.
We was just talking about quips, said Gorm.
Oh. Yeah, you're allowed to make one, said Katha dully.
Lass, are you feeling well?
Asked Gorm. Katha looked around at the concerned faces.
No. No, it must be something I ate. I need to lie down.
She stood slowly, unfolding like a rusted training golem, before making some half-hearted goodbyes. A sudden shaking came over her, and she pulled her cloak close to ward off the night's chill before she headed for the copse of trees where her tent was set up.
I have concerns about our ranger, Jin murmured once the elf was out of sight.
Aye, said Gorm.
Katha hadn't been herself for a while, but over the past day, whatever condition she was in had deteriorated.
Do you suppose she's sick?
I didn't think elves got sick, said Heraldin. Laruna opened her mouth to say something, but then shook her head.
Maybe it's the wine, she muttered.
She didn't have any, Jin countered.
Maybe that's the problem, said Gorm. Let's talk to her about it in the morning. Perhaps a good night's sleep will improve things.
It's getting worse, murmured Katha. I can't sleep.
What is it?
Nothing.
Katha sat up in her bedroll. The moonlight outside shone through the fabric of her tent, casting her pack and gear in sapphire hues. The camp outside the tent was silent.
And then there was...
Katha shook her head.
It's nothing.
Oh, come on. It isn't nothing. You can tell me.
Well, there's a turtle in my tent, said Katha.
Tortoise, said the tortoise.
Right, sorry, said Katha. There's a tortoise in my tent, and most tortoises I've encountered didn't glow blue or float in the air. Or talk.
Maybe I'm your spirit animal, suggested the tortoise.
Like the ones that guided the old elves on their things?
Katha blinked a few times. It was hard to find the things. Words.
Spirit journeys?
Yeah, those. Are you here to guide me on a spirit journey?
Why not? Said the tortoise. Come on, let's go.
Oh, wait, no, I can't.
Katha shook her head.
We're on a mission. We've got to stop Jin's father from being a lich, doing something bad, and then help the orcs after that, I think. Something.
Well, all the more reason to go on a spirit journey, said the tortoise. Taking time for self-discovery can lead you to an epiphany that unlocks your true potential.
Katha rubbed her eyes.
What?
Come on, said the tortoise, already floating toward the tent flap.
Yeah, all right, said Katha. Just let me get... I need my stuff. Gear. Let me put on my armor.
Katha, said the tortoise, do you really think weapons and armor will help you on a spirit journey?
The ranger thought about it.
No, I suppose not, she said. That'd be ridiculous.
Exactly. Come on.
The tortoise slipped through the tent door. Katha grabbed a cloak and slipped from her tent into the cold evening. The stars were still winking into sight across the deep blue sky. To the southeast, she could see the orange glow of the fading cook fire through the trees. She turned and walked north, relishing the cool mud on her bare feet.
We need to hurry, she told the tortoise. We're only a day away from High Watch.
She gestured southeast, where the mountains blotted out the stars on the horizon.
Don't worry about that, the tortoise reassured her as it floated north. Focus on reaching your full potential, on finding that epiphany that leads to inner peace.
Okay.
Katha took a deep breath.
Epiphany.
They wandered across the moonlit countryside for what seemed like hours. Her cloak offered a little protection from the cold, and she clutched it tightly around herself. The small tortoise hovered by her shoulder, rambling on about the finer points of spiritual awakening. As they journeyed onward, though, her thoughts cleared. The crisp air felt good in her nostrils and lungs, and the more she breathed it in, the less she noticed the chill. Her limbs filled with warmth and energy, giving her steps a renewed vigor. By the time she saw the first hint of dawn's light on the eastern horizon, she was practically dancing over the grassland.
Feeling good? Asked the tortoise.
I feel great, said Katha. Though, you know, I thought a spirit journey would be different.
I'm glad, said the tortoise, beaming. But what were you expecting?
Well, in all the stories about spirit journeys that I've ever heard, the elves encounter different animal spirits that ask insightful questions, and that's what drives the elf toward introspection and then enlightenment. So I just assumed, you know, that we'd meet a bear or a fox or something out here.
So far I'm it, said the tortoise. I could try asking you personal questions.
Sounds good, said Katha, leaping over a small stream.
All right, said the tortoise. Have you been thinking about healing potions much lately?
Oh, that's what this is about?
Katha's mood curdled.
You dragged me all the way out here to have a talk about salve?
Haven't you been pulling away from your friends lately? Asked the tortoise. Haven't you been sore and hurting for days, only thinking about getting more potions?
I like potions, said Katha. I want them because they're fun, not because I need them. I could stop if I wanted to.
Remember the salve heads you saw when Leary sent you to Lady Fjord's Gardens of Recovery for your drinking? Asked the tortoise. Didn't they say the same thing?
I am not like the salve heads, snarled Katha. Listen, these questions aren't very insightful. I'm going to go talk to that spirit falcon instead.
No, no,
said the glowing green falcon, alighting on a nearby stump.
I think the tortoise has a point.
It's time to admit you have a problem, said the tortoise. That's the first step to recovery.
Katha sighed.
Fine, she hissed through her teeth. I have a little problem with salve, and it's bothering me because I haven't gone this long without a kick in a long time. I was supposed to get some in Andoran, but now I just need to get a potion so I can make it through this battle at High Watch and save the world. Then I'll check into Lady Fjord's and take care of my little issue.
Did I say little? Said the tortoise.
You didn't say little,
said the falcon, because I heard her say little. The tortoise floated over to hover beside his avian counterpart.
She said little twice, said the falcon.
I didn't think I came here to talk about a little problem, said the tortoise.
You didn't say little,
reiterated the falcon. Let me be clear, said the tortoise, turning back to Caitha. You have a huge problem with healing potions. A healing potion crisis, really. And you know you do, because you saw what the elixir addicts went through at Lady Fjord's when they stopped getting kicks.
Reduced social interactions, said the falcon. Trouble concentrating. Sallow complexion.
Sound familiar? Said the tortoise.
The worst part comes after the shakes,
the falcon said to the tortoise. Oh, it's awful, agreed the tortoise. He looked to Caitha. You remember the final stage of elixir withdrawal?
Hallucinations, said Caitha. Icy fear hit her in the gut.
And delusions,
said the falcon. Like talking spirit animals, said the tortoise.
I'm hallucinating, said Caitha, and now I've wandered off, and all my weapons and armor, and oh gods,
Yes, said the tortoise.
I have a huge problem with salve, sobbed Caitha.
The tortoise nodded sagely. Good, good. Now, remember that on the other side of withdrawal. Admitting your problem is the first step to recovery. The falcon spread its wings as the tortoise started slowly ascending.
Wait, cried Caitha. Don't just leave me out here.
Sorry. But you've had your epiphany, said the tortoise. I've helped you all I can. Now it's up to you to follow your path and reach your true potential. Besides, I don't want to be here for what comes next.
Oh, yeah, said the falcon. Things are about to get weird.
Really weird, agreed the luminous tortoise. Hey, where are you headed anyway?
There's a shaman up in House Galantia that just ate a bowl of night mushrooms,
said the falcon.
I'm going to go have a talk with him about his relationship with his father.
Sounds fun. Mind if I come with? The tortoise was ascending rapidly now, keeping pace with the falcon as it flapped away into the sky.
Not at all. I'd welcome the company,
said the falcon.
Wait!
Caitha shouted after the retreating spirit animals. I need help! And now that you've recognized that, you're ready to move forward, the tortoise called back to her. Good work.
No, I mean your help, cried Caitha. Help getting back to camp.
Some journeys you must walk alone, yelled the tortoise, now merely a blue dot among the fading stars. Or something like that.
Close enough,
said the falcon. Then they were gone, disappearing into a sky that was starting to melt and run down over the plains. The moon opened its great eye, and its laughter summoned spider squids with tongues of flame from the earth and water. Sobbing and screaming, Caitha turned and fled into a nightmare.